This is July 6, 2008. It's part three of our ongoing conversation with Gerd Stern, poet of communication, among many other things. We're emphasizing at this point the stay in San Francisco, which comes up to around 1960, 61, and then Gerd goes back to New York. But before we go back to New York, I thought of someone who I wondered if Gerd knew or encountered. Gerd, did you ever hear or see or get to know and talk to Lord Buckley?
I knew Lord Buckley on the West Coast. I admired him and his lady. I admired the way he conducted himself. My favorite saying of his is, people are the true flowers of life, and it has been my privilege to walk in the garden.
Yes, I've heard that. I've heard Bob Fass say that, I think.
I told it to Bob. Bob, of course, was very familiar with Buckley's work. I really don't know, to tell you the truth, at the moment, whether they ever met each other.
Right, well,
possible.
How did you meet Lord Buckley?
He was around the jazz scene in California.
Is that the Black Hawk Club, or is that in New York? I can't remember where
the Black Hawk was in San Francisco, and, off Van Ness a couple of blocks. And I used to spend most evenings there, commuting from San Francisco, to hear my friends play and to sit at the bar with Ralph Gleason, who only drank milk because he had an ulcer.
Right. Now, Ralph, did you admire his critical abilities in jazz?
Yeah, sure. I mean, he was a friend of most of the people who played, and he was pretty nice to everybody, I thought.
Was he older than you? I'm just going to check this. Or is he around your age? Is he died early?
I think he was a little older than I, but, you can check it. I don't know.
Yeah, he was 11 years older, born in 1917.
Mm-hmm.
And he died in 1975.
I'm not surprised.
So with Buckley, you saw him...
last time I saw him was in Mill Valley, actually. In Mill Valley. He did a gig in Mill Valley at, I can't remember, it's some bar or a club. After we went and got high with some other people, we had a good time.
Was he a manic, in quotes, when he was high, when he wasn't on stage? Was he a different
was
person?
Was he manic?
Well, creative, improvising when he wasn't off stage.
I think he was more relaxed than that. He was a pretty relaxed cat.
So he'd be thinking. He wouldn't be improvising verbally all the time.
No. I mean, if at a party or something, you'd ask him to do one of his shticks.
Yeah.
You could probably talk him into it.
What did Ann think of him? Did Ann enjoy that scene?
I don't remember Ann being part of that at all, to tell you the truth. She didn't used to come with me to the Black Hawk either, except once in a great while.
So she was working on her poetry projects with...
No, she was... she was really an activist. I mean, you remember the Birdman of Alcatraz?
Yeah. Saw the movie, yeah.
No, not the movie. The actual guy who was in San Quentin and who, they finally eliminated, but Anne and her cohorts, used to advocate, freeing him or at least not killing him.
He was on death row?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I saw the movie. I knew it was based on a true story, but I'm not familiar with it other than the movie. So they were trying to release him, get him out.
Yes, they were, and she was involved in a lot of stuff like that. And through that, got involved with other men, and et cetera, et cetera.
So you guys split around 1960-61?
Well, this is another strange event. This guy, Joe, who I knew from New Paltz because he was married to the next door farmer's to a relative, and he came out, unannounced, and needed a place to stay, and so he stayed with us on the barge, and after a few days, and ran off with him. That only lasted a very short while. But Joe Kerrigan, and that was it.
And were you guys having affairs anyways before that with other people?
I don't know if having is the right word, but there were affairs, yes,
right,
on both sides.
Did they cause jealousy or friction, or you guys accepted that?
I think the answer to that is if they were known, they
cause a problem.
Jealousy. But I think most of them were only supposed.
Right. Now, just before you leave, we go back to New York City. A little bit more about Anne.
Not to New York City, to New York State.
Right. The poems in folio, we talked about that in the last session. Stanley Kunitz and Ted Rutke, they had a big influence on Anne's idea of what poetry was.
Well, Ted was her professor at Seattle, Washington, the university.
University of Washington, probably.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. That's where he taught. And Stanley, when Ted had sabbatical, Stanley took his place, and Stanley and Anne had an affair.
And when she was still a student? When she was a student there?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it was like she went back to school, as I remember, after her first marriage to a musician, composer, whose name I can't recall, but there were a whole bunch of poets out there, Carolyn Kaiser and David Wagoner, who were kind of a couple for a while, although then Carolyn became the poet laureate. Is that what it's called in the U.S.?
I only know that in England. I don't know what it is here.
Well, there is one,
Yeah.
And she had political influence through a lawyer who was supposed to sit on the Supreme Court. Jewish lawyer, but there was some obstacle which prevented him from being there. I can't remember his name either, although everybody knows it.
Not Melvin Belli.
No, not in San Francisco, in Washington, D.C.
Okay, but we're talking about this...
Carolyn,
she, through political influence, became poet laureate? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Yeah. I've never heard of her. So she had that role for a while as American.
Yeah, and she was like Anne's best friend. And we were friendly, but afterwards she made some very hateful remarks about me, verbally and in print.
After you and split?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, you're saying that there was this poet these were San Francisco poets, not Seattle poets.
No. They were Northwest poets.
Oh.
Those people that I mentioned, Carolyn and David.
Right.
Yeah, and they're good poets, by the way.
So, how long did Anne live? Is she still alive?
No. She's been dead for nearly 30 years.
Mm.
Died of cancer. She was a heavy smoker. Heavy. I mean, cigarettes.
Was she about your age?
She was a little younger.
Right. So,
not much.
In this period in San Francisco, before you go back to New York State, you meet Howard Gossage, right?
I knew Howard for a long time. Howard and Al Toffler,
You knew the Tofflers. You knew the Tofflers?
I didn't know the Tofflers. I knew him.
Al Toffler.
Yes.
Alvin Toffler.
But, there were a lot of... That was a big group of people. And some of them, you remember I was also working for Playboy.
Yes.
Herbert Gold came out through Playboy.
Yes.
And he became a big San Francisco number, and he still is, actually.
Yeah, I always get him mixed up with Herb Cain.
They were very different. They're very different people. Of course, Herb Cain is dead, but Herbert Gold is still alive. He wrote this book called Therefore Be Bold by Herbert Gold.
It doesn't list it under...
Yeah, he was a Playboy writer.
Oh, but it says his works are Birth of a Hero, 51, The Prospect Before Us, 54.
Lots of books.
Yeah, The Man Who Was Not With It, 1956.
Yeah, he wrote a piece about it, me, really, in the San Francisco Chronicle one time. I mean, it wasn't all about me, but anyway, about the period.
Right. So he is born in 1924... And Herb Cain, who's dead, may be about the same age. I just checked that. No, 1916, so he's the same age as Ralph Gleason. So the, was there, they say Herb Gold was a novelist. Was he a columnist or just a novelist?
No, a novelist and a short story writer and a prose writer. No, he wasn't a journalist.
What do you remember about him, and what was your relationship with
about Herb?
Yeah, Herb Gold.
One day, Augie Spektorsky called me and said, "Hey, Gerd, Herb Gold is coming out. He wants to see what San Francisco is like. Would you please introduce him to the people you know?" So I introduced him to the people I knew, quite a lot of them, Rex Roth, Gossage. Lots of people, and he became a social lion. He's got a rather heavy duty ego. Don't get me wrong, he's okay. We got along, but he's not my style. If you understand what I mean?
Yeah. But the thing is that
he's not a hipster,
right?
Kind of, a hanger-on, but, much more really middle class.
Right, and so you have an interesting position being in PR in San Francisco. You are introducing a lot of people to a lot of people. That's just, with your Playboy connection, people come out from the East Coast, coming through Playboy, meet you, so.
Not from the East Coast, from the Midwest.
Yeah.
Playboy is Chicago. But but not just through that. I mean, through the poetry world, through all kinds of people that one knew in the East, and the jazz world. Man, the jazz world was a heavy duty world, and so was the head world.
Right, and your barge became something that people would visit. I don't know if we talked enough about the jazz guys and other people coming to your barge. It was unique to be on a barge?
No, there are lots of people on barges in Sausalito, but, you know, I mean, they weren't necessarily jazz addicts like we were. We being... You're confusing two periods, though, you know.
So the barge is before the PR period? Is that what you're saying?
Well, the barge was, sure, before the... The barge was when I was first when I was married to Jane, and when Buckwheat and Old Bill and Pam lived there. So the barge goes through those periods. It goes through that period, through the Maya period. Well, of course, that was a whole other world of entertainers, and then through the Anne period.
So you were
after Anne. After Anne, I. You know, I stayed there by myself, and then eventually I met Barbara McCallum there, and that's what drew me back to New York State.
Right. So the so you were in your circle, you were one of the rare people to have a barge. Maybe that's the point, that in the jazz and poetry world, they would get on the barge through you.
Well, yeah, it was a big barge, and it was a party barge. But there were other, you know, big ones. And for instance, Varda, who lived in half of the ferry boat Vallejo, I mean, every weekend was a huge party of artists from all over the world, musicians, whatever, and, sailing on his. He had a boat with one of those lateen rigs. And we could get a lot of people in that boat. It was always a lot of fun.
Yeah, you mentioned him as a good friend of Alan Watts. Varda.
Well, they lived on each half of the Vallejo. They certainly knew each other. I wouldn't say that they were best of friends or anything. I mean, it was Gordon Onslow Ford's ferry boat.
It was called Vallejo.
The Vallejo, yeah. It's a historic boat, and somebody has done a history of it.
Oh. Now, I'm just looking at Herbert Gold. There's an interesting fact. He was married to Melissa Dilworth. Do you remember her?
Nope.
Well, he had three children with her.
Yes, but I didn't know her, and I didn't know the children.
Right, but here's the thing. After Herb and Melissa divorced, Melissa became involved with concert promoter Bill Graham, dying in the helicopter crash that took Graham's life in 1991.
Well, that was much later.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, they must have been divorced long before that, and I never heard of her in San Francisco.
Mm.
When he moved out to San Francisco, he was alone already.
Okay.
So what?
I just thought. No.
I mean, so what about that old trip?
Yeah, it was just a coincidence. Bill Graham, I remember when he died.
Bill was a refugee.
Yes. So did you know him before he got into the Fillmore scene? Was he on the?
I knew him when he was with the San Francisco
Mime Troupe. Was it?
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, you knew that group then.
Yeah, I mean, San Francisco's not New York.
Right. Did you ever... I remember seeing around 1970, 71, films of The Committee. They were pretty funny improvising.
Yeah, the guy I've talked about a lot, Bill Loughborough, was part of The Committee.
Ah!
But that was later.
You mean you talked about not in our dialogue, but in the oral history of Bancroft, you mean?
No, and I talked about him. He lived on the barge. He was part of Boo Bam Bamboo Drums.
What's his name? Bill?
Loughborough, and he's the guy who brought the electronic equipment for Harry Parches, so when we built the Eroica, remember?
That
story.
Right, right. But that's not part of the Old Bill and Buckwheat gang, is it?
Yes, it is. That is Old Bill.
Oh, he's Old Bill. Okay.
All right. And he's still alive. He lives up in the Northwest somewhere.
Hmm. So, Okay, we did Lord Buckley, Anne Runs Off. So how do you meet Barbara McCollum?
He was such a curious fellow, you know. I'm going one night to a party in San Francisco, and I'm taking Steve Reich's wife.
Steve Reich, the musician.
Yes. Steve is somewhere else. I'm taking her, but I'm not going home with her. I'm going home with Barbara McCollum, who I meet at the party. She's just out from Rockland County, and we get it on. She comes over to the barge with me, and we do it all night long, and over breakfast she says, "Boy, that was the best fuck I've had in weeks."
And you fell in love with her for saying that.
Well, I laughed my head off, but, you know. But, so then she says, "You know, I live with all these people that you know in Rockland County." Because that was the Black Mountain gang.
Hey, is that near New Paltz? Is that part of the New Paltz?
No. It's
John Cage.
Yeah, John and David Tudor and MC Richards and Paul Williams and Vera and the Hultbergs and Stan Vanderbeek and, you know, and David Weinrib and Karen Carnes, et cetera, Lanou Davenport. And, okay, so she said, "Why don't you, hey, you're not sat here, come back. I have a very nice house and you're welcome."
What was your career at that? What were you doing to make some money at that point?
I was doing odd jobs in carpentry.
Right. Just before we get into that, we forgot to talk a bit about Poems and Folio. We did mention that and involvement in making, you made about 12 of them, I think, or something.
11.
And was there a little bit more about Ted Rodkey and Stanley Kunitz? We may not.
Well, Stanley was one of our editors. Ted was not. I think Richard Wilbur, who was kind of related, and he's still around.
Yeah.
To Ann was one of our editors. I can't remember who was the other one. But like I think I told you, it kind of got out of my world.
Yeah.
Into the big poet's poetry. But they're very beautiful. I sold all the signed copies except one that I kept for myself to a guy who's no longer alive, a rare book dealer named Henry Wenning, years and years ago. I mean, I think before, about the time I left San Francisco, and I still have lots of the edition, which, you know, the regular edition, not signed by the poets.
Right. Now, when that finishes, does Anne stay in the poetry world? What does she do after she runs off with this Joe guy, and then that ends in a couple of weeks? What does she do?
She eventually winds up in Buffalo, New York, teaching old English, Chaucer and stuff at SUNY Buffalo. And she then gets married to an artist named Tom, and she has Jared, our son. After she left, her family hired detectives to investigate me. and she wouldn't let me see Jared for a while. And we kind of worked out something, but it didn't work out very well. And then when she was in Buffalo, she was really pissed at me for some unknown reason. But by that time, we were in USCO, and we were Intermedia 68, I believe it was, and one of the venues that the New York State Council on the Arts sent us to was the University of Buffalo, and I wanted to see Jared. So she said no. So I called John Hightower, who was the head of the... He called Governor Rockefeller.
Mm-hmm.
And Governor Rockefeller called the president of the university. And he said, this is one of our well-known artists. And I understand that his ex-wife works for you, and he wants to see his son. Could you please make that possible? And he did.
But that's because you've been on the cover of Life magazine, so...
But, I mean, John Hightower was a wonderful human being. And, you know, I knew him well because I was on a lot of the panels of the New York State Council. And, you know, I had a whole bunch of friends who worked for the council, Ken Dewey.
Right.
Yeah, so...
So we'll get into that, but that's interesting,
John. So I knew John, you know, and he and Rockefeller, he was Rockefeller's protege.
Hmm. Oh, in the sense of becoming a governor? Is that what you mean?
No, in the arts, you know, Nelson Rockefeller was...
A patron.
Huge in the arts, and Hightower, he made Hightower the head of the State Council on the Arts.
Right.
He really trusted his judgment.
Okay, now when Ann was in SUNY Buffalo, was that where Charles Olson was? I know he had something...
Bob... oh, my God. What's the matter? There are a number of poets there, but...
not Olson.
Charles, by that time, was in Gloucester.
Gloucester, England? Or Massachusetts?
No, Gloucester, Massachusetts.
Okay. So Anne became a professor and an expert on medieval scripts.
Well, I don't know, an expert, but she taught that, yes. That was her field.
Always was. That's what she learned in Seattle.
In a way, yeah.
Yeah. So
and
she
poetry.
So she was an intellectual, an academic.
Yeah, she was that, and she was also vice president of the National Organization of Women during that same period, and she ran for some kind of state office, and she didn't win.
So that's now.
Yes, that's now.
Just look, that's the National, just see if they, looking up the history, would she be, she was one of the founders.
I don't know. She was an officer.
And,
I didn't say founder, I said officer.
So she, was she a blatant militant feminist?
Yes, kind of.
That's why she hated you. You think she had something against you on that level?
Well, I mean, she was rebelling against her parents by being with me in the first place.
Yeah.
And it kind of wore out.
Okay. Barbara McCollum, you have no reason to stay in San Francisco. You're not doing PR.
I rent the barge. I get in my little English sunset. Sunbird Talbot.
Right.
Right. Not Sunbird, but Sun something. And a convertible, and I drive with a wire recorder, and I'm singing across the desert and the prairie into this wire recorder, which, you know, it was... I guess it was what I could afford because there were tape recorders around.
A wire recorder, what's that?
Well, that was before tape. This thin kind of aluminy, steely colored wire on spools. And you could record with it. If when those wires tangled, it was good night. You couldn't get them.
Mm.
It wasn't like tape where you could, you know, untwist and untangle and cut and splice and so forth.
So you're driving. Oh, you want to say a little more about that?
No,
okay.
I still somewhere have a tape that I made later of that singing.
So is Barbara in the car with you?
No, she's long gone. She looked. That was one night.
Oh, so she just tells you about this place, and you say, yeah, I want to go there.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you go there and show up yourself. Do you know John Cage already at that point?
No. But I know M.C. Richards. I know the Williams. I knew Ethel Hultberg, although not by that name.
You knew of him through the Harry Park musical?
Of John?
Yeah.
I knew of him.
Do you remember reading Alan Watts' criticism of John Cage applying Zen to music? Do you remember that essay?
No, I don't.
Okay, that's just at that time was a famous essay. Watts, the authority on Zen, criticizing John Cage's use of Zen.
That's ridiculous.
Okay, so you drive.
I mean, John certainly was the. He had some other prejudices, but he was a very spiritual guy.
John Cage, yes. John Cage, you're talking about.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, how close are you to Howard Gossage when you leave, rent the barge, and go back to New York? Is he just an acquaintance?
I'm never that close to him. He's just somebody that I've been at bars with and at parties with and introduced people to, and he's introduced people to me.
Right.
For various reasons.
Was he a hipster?
No. He was a businessman. And he was a playboy. And he was... he prided himself on his sophistication of everything. Clothes, decor, food. He was somewhat of a snob.
Mm. Okay, so you... What are you recording in the car? Songs, poetry?
I'm singing poetry.
Your own? You're making it up? Or?
Yeah, I'm making it up as I go along.
You're inspired. You hadn't done that
yet? Yeah, I'm having a great time driving across the country. I don't have very much money, but enough to buy the gas. And I mostly sleep in the car. So, whatever.
And do you have any memories of scenes, scenery, or people going across?
Oh, it was great. I remember the desert. I remember the Midwest. It was a great trip. I had a wonderful time. I was all by myself, which is unusual in my life.
Yeah. And you're not in touch with Maya, I assume, at that time. She's gone? How do you like that early?
Yeah, Maya, I don't know where she is by this time.
And how
she
old
may
is...
Be, she may already be in Africa, I'm not sure.
Right. And how old is Jared? When was he born?
How old is he when I leave? Probably something like 4, 5.
Okay, in your mind, are the Kennedys president yet? Is Nixon?
I was in San Francisco when JFK was assassinated.
No, that's 63. That's after New York. That's after going back with them. I know
you're
that.
Right. Yes.
So we're talking about he's running against Nixon. Did you see the Nixon-Kennedy TV debates? Did you follow that at all?
No, I doubt it.
And so you don't have a clear image of who was president when you're driving across the country?
No.
Eisenhower or... I'm just trying to get a sense of the date. You know that you're going to be...
I can figure out the dates, but,
So Jared may be born about 57, 56?
Maybe.
Yeah.
He was in his... I can look it up.
Okay, is he the computer prodigy?
No.
Which son is that? That's Zal?
Zalman.
When is he born?
Jared is dead. He died of an overdose.
Okay, and it's not Adam. Adam dies too.
Adam died of muscular dystrophy.
How old is Jared when he dies?
38, I believe.
So in the 90s?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Exactly. But Zalman whose son is he? Judith?
Yep.
Yeah, okay. So you're going, you're in a great mood, and you show up in Rockland County, and you drive up to MC Richards' place, or who do you go?
No, I actually drive to Paul and Ethel Huffbert's place,
and
which is near the what's called the land, but not on it, because they got thrown out a little earlier.
Is that the scene with Thorberg? Is it Thorsten? What was that?
No, Thorberg was with Jane.
Okay, yeah. So how do you know? I don't know the name Paul.
Paul Williams from Black Mountain.
Oh, the guy, the money behind it, the guy who had...
Yeah, and then architect, builder.
So do you call him up and tell him you're coming, or you just go find him?
Barbara makes the arrangements. No, they don't know I'm coming.
Right.
Paul and MC and all those people don't know I'm coming.
So you
don't know that I've met Barbara.
Okay, so you drive up to Paul's home?
No, it's Paul Hultberg. That's a different Paul. Because they're friends of Barbara's, and Barbara wasn't at home, and she left me a message at the door saying, meet me at the Hultbergs. I'll be there later, but they're expecting you. And with a map, and I go there. It's just about 3-4 minutes away.
And is Barbara there when you get there?
No, but she shows up later.
Okay. You mean like a day or two, or...?
No, a couple of hours.
Oh, okay. So the timing is... Well, how long did it take you to go across the country?
Yeah, I don't know, 5 days.
Okay, so you go and you meet this Paul Huffberg.
Paul I never met. Ethel I knew in the village in the late 40s or early 50s.
So there's a core of these...
I didn't know that I was going to see her again, but we recognized each other.
So, again, it's the bohemian world out of the village. They have
I used to meet her at with the Kecks, Betty and Bill Keck and Bob and his wife who went and founded some kind of a cult in South America, Bob Stock, poet.
That wasn't the...
Jackson McClough used to be there, and Ethel, and two or three other Jewish young ladies who were also involved in Hechalutz, which is, you know, they have farms in the U.S. where they train Jewish youth to go join the kibbutz movement.
Mm. And who was the couple that you named who did that? Who organized that?
Were the girls, Ethel and Adele, and I can't remember the two sisters' names.
When you mentioned the cult in South America, you don't mean Oscar or Caizos?
No, that was much later. This is way early. Bob Stock and his wife, Harriet, I believe her name was Harriet. The only people I know who still know them, I think it's Jerry Rothenberg, who knew them.
But what was the cult? What was the content of the cult?
I don't know. It was, you know, one of those communities, but in a very early community, libertarians and food fattists. And
right.
It was very early. This is, I'm talking about the 40s.
Hmm. Did you ever run across a psychologist, I guess he was, named Harry Stack Sullivan? Does that mean anything to you at Columbia University?
Yeah, I know the name, but I didn't know him personally, no.
Yeah, because he had some high profile in academia in the early 50s, and I noticed McLuhan read him and commented on him.
Yeah, he was definitely read in those days, but lots of people were. I mean,
yeah,
we were, you know, we were pretty conversant with Jung, and certainly with Freud and Adler.
So you end up at the Huffbergs, is the name?
The Huffbergs, for the afternoon, and then I got there in the afternoon, and then when Barbara arrived, we went back to her house, and I lived with her for months, or maybe a year.
And what came out of that
relationship? And her two children.
What happened in that relationship? What do you remember? What artworks or activities were you involved in with Barbara?
Well, that's when I started. That's when I got a start. That's when I read McLuhan. And that's when I started making three-dimensional electronic pieces. And that's when I had my first show. And we broke up just before that show.
The one in San Francisco, or was the one
in the coast? In New York.
Right.
The Alan Stone Gallery.
Yes. So
Steve Durkee.
Right.
It's a little complicated little period.
Right, but what's interesting is I know that McLuhan's is called, it's the precursor to his famous book, Understanding Media. And
it was the reports of the National Association of Educational Broadcasters, which John Cage lent to MC Richards, and MC persuaded John that I needed to read it, so she lent it to me.
Right, now that is done in 61, 60, 61.
Oh, come on.
Oh, yeah, no, I have a copy right here.
Are you sure it's not earlier?
Oh, no. He McLuhan...
Oh, you're right. It's 61, because I had my show in 62. You're right.
Yeah. And what he did is he went around and visited these different professors part of his 50s.
Okay, so I was living with Barbara in, 59, 60, kind of. No. Probably 60, 61.
You start the 60s in New York, you could say. You leave San Francisco.
Yeah.
And so, you're with her for a year, and you...
Around a year, yeah.
And you get
and
that...
Then Steve was just moving up to the country toward the middle of our relationship. And I helped him at the church, and then he helped me. We built a wonderful bathroom at Barbara's house with a tree in the middle of it, an open shower without any curtains or anything. And it was really nice. And then she wanted me to start on the kitchen, and I was angry. So I stopped talking. I
know you report. You read. Say this in the Bancroft. You don't talk for a long time.
It was for a long time, and all kinds of my friends come and they say, "Look, we understand that you're not talking, but you could talk to us. we're not part of. But I wouldn't talk to anybody."
And how long does that go on? A couple of weeks, or a month, or 5 days?
At least a couple of weeks or a month, yes.
And you're still living with Barbara?
Yes, but we're no longer, as intimate as we were. And I'm pissed.
Because you aren't intimate, you mean?
No, I'm pissed because, we did this wonderful job and built this great bathroom, and then when we finished, she says, "Oh, now it's time for you to start on the kitchen." Well, I wasn't I wasn't hired help.
Yes.
And I got mad. I said, "I'm not ready to do anybody's kitchen."
You were insulted.
Yeah, it was like "Oh, sure, we'll do the kitchen and next we'll do the I got all these things for you to do." Well, I was busy getting my show together. Paul Williams was helping me build the pieces.
Is she same age as you, Barbara, or younger, older?
She was about the same age.
Right. So Steve Durkee is a big connection, but before we go into this, let's just go a little bit more in about this document that you read. It was published by the National Association of Broadcasters, or they.
It was kind of in paper, a huge paper manuscript.
Right, and I don't know if Cage how he eventually is very involved with McLuhan, but I don't know.
Marshall sent him a copy as soon as he got it because he wanted Cage's opinion of it.
Right, so he probably met Cage, I don't know, but late 50s then.
Probably,
because Cage writes about visiting Marshall in his books, visiting Marshall around that time. It's right, 66-1, 62. So I know that he traveled around in the fall of 59, McLuhan, fall of 59, early 60, interviewing really people of his own network, people who already were interested in his writings. And he composed this report, which was probably already in his mind what he would find and what his formula would be. The medium as the message would be his big point. And it became, I don't know if you know this, became discussed in Congress as an outrage. The funding of this mad Canadian professor who was spit upon in Congress by somebody.
Really? That was only one of the times that he had problems, because the next time was at Fordham, right?
Yes. So so there was controversy around it, and you can get it from the Ann Arbor University Microfilms has copies of it. They have all the PhDs. All the PhDs in, it's in Ann Arbor, but he would have sent whenever it got typed up by his wife, probably, Corinne.
No. This was an actual report. It wasn't a manuscript.
You mean it was the final government publication?
It was bound, yes.
Right. Oh, okay.
But it was like a paper, not hard.
Right. Soft bound, maybe they call it.
Yeah, right.
But the thing is that would have to be... See, what happens is that he gets ill in the middle of this 59 to 60. I know that he submits it around June 60, but he's ill, and he almost dies. And he tells Ted Carpenter that he wished he'd died because he had done God's work, and he was happy with what he produced. So that was an interesting story from Ted Carpenter. And Ted writes about it, I think, in Don Thiel's book. There's an appendix by Ted Carpenter. Anyway, so Marshall survives. We actually have footage of him doing a CBC play skit about young kids around the Lolita movie. And that's an exhibit. The transcript of that is in this report. So when you see the footage of him, he looks quite swollen in the head. He doesn't look well. It doesn't look like the way he usually does. So he's ill in doing the report in that period. He recovers. And when you get the thing now, it's dated 1962, but I know that it was finished in 60. They probably released it by 61, and so we could probably pin it down that you got it in 61.
Okay.
Now that's like after a year with Barbara, you know what I mean? It's like the near...
It's during the time I'm with Barbara.
Right. And meanwhile, though, you've met Cage. No, you haven't. M.C. Richards.
Yeah, I've met John, yes.
Has he talked about McLuhan to you before you get the report?
No.
It's M.C. Richards who tells you and says, hey...
Yes, because she had the copy. Cover, yes.
And she wasn't supposed to lend it out or something, and she...
She just asked John, and John said, sure.
Oh, I thought that she said, well, I'll tell John I'm still reading it and give it to you.
No.
So there was no privacy about it there. So you read it, and what do you make of it?
I get totally turned on.
Can you describe why, at that time, in your mind, why you were turned on by it? Well, why was it so meaningful?
Well, it was kind of resonated with my ideas in general, and I was already kind of interested in media, through KPFA and through...
Public relations.
Not through public relations, but through, public television, which I was interested in, and I was beginning to think in terms of images and in terms of, objects rather than just writing poetry, and...
thinking that way? What was it that...
I was... as usual, smoking grass and reading McLuhan, and I really at the it was inspirational. I've had a few inspirational, you know, encounters in my life, and that was one of them. I mean, when I was a kid, reading Andre, oh my God, you know, the great French prose writer.
Andre Malraux?
No.
Saint-Exupéry?
Who am I talking about? I'm talking about, not about existentialism, but...
Surrealist, Breton?
No. Much more solid writer. Starts with a G.
Andre somebody, Gio.
No, maybe it wasn't Andre. I'm losing it.
The thing is that...
The counterfeiters?
Oh, Huxley.
No.
No, Somerset Maugham?
No, French.
Yeah,
the counterfeiters, look it up.
Okay, but the this is when you're a teenager?
This is when I'm... yeah, it's like when I'm... And I'm either still with my parents or just afterwards.
Yes, it's not Count Alfred, whatever his name is, Camus.
No, it's not Camus. It wasn't the counterfeiters. So,
I'm just looking it up. The movie, the counterfeiters, Jewish counterfeiter in the movie, fictionalizes Operation Bernard. Nah, secret plan for the Nazis. That's not it, is it?
No, it's a book. It's a literary.
Is that the theme, though?
No, it's not the theme. It's the title.
Oh, it's André Gide.
André Gide. Exactly. It was his. It wasn't the counterfeiters, although I read that. It was his journals that really turned me on. It was okay to be self-conscious.
Right, this would be the Nouvelle Revue Française. They say published in the Nouvelle Revue Française. Like,
no, the journals were huge books, and there were quite a few of them, and I borrowed them from the library.
Yeah, it's called. It says here, Journal of the Counterfeiters.
No, the Counterfeiters is a novel.
Right, but under they list that, then they have André Gide, Journal of the Counterfeiters.
I don't know. His journals were published, year by, I don't know how many volumes, 3 or 4. And he wrote letters and, you know, a lot of correspondence and a lot of diary entries, and I never thought it was okay to be self-conscious, but he persuaded me that it was okay to be self-conscious.
And that would
be...
That was
inspiring.
What does it mean to be self-conscious, to write about your awkwardness in different situations?
Well, to realize that you as an individual are a subject of yourself, so you don't have to be embarrassed about, who you are and what and how you express yourself.
All right, so and how did this, did you read it in the newspaper, or was there a book?
No, it was his journals.
That he got published, yeah, that's what they list. They don't give any details, they just list it as the Journal of the Counterfeiters.
That's wrong, but whatever, it doesn't matter. I'm telling you that's what influenced me, but...
Right.
And Harry Parch was another of those experiences.
And also that Jaime Dangulo.
Jaime Dangulo, right.
Yeah, and then Harry Parch. So you would say McLuhan is the next one?
Yeah.
This André Gide, born in 1869,
uh-huh.
Died in 51. He won the Nobel Prize in Literature in 1947. Did that?
Right.
Is that what drew your attention to him, or were you already reading him?
I was reading him originally it was at somebody's house that I had read The Counterfeiters. I think it was at that guy that I told you about who worked for the United Nations.
Yeah, your first
translator.
And he was your first guy to give you grass, too, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. It says here, Gide, known for his fiction as well as his autobiographical works, Gide exposes to public view the conflict and eventual reconciliation between the two sides of his personality.
Well, of course, he was gay.
Oh, okay.
But that didn't impress me. His the breadth of his thinking and his willingness to expose himself.
Right.
What got to me.
The two sides of his personality split apart.
And a beautiful writer. I mean.
Hmm. I haven't read him. Between the two sides of his personality, split apart by a straight-laced education and a narrow social moralism, Gide's work can be seen as an investigation of freedom and empowerment in the face of moralistic and Puritan constraints, and gravitates around his continuous effort to achieve intellectual honesty.
Aside from that, he was a big influence in France, a liberal influence. I mean, he advocated a lot of causes in those days, and a lot of some of Breton and other people did also, but he was an active participant in those literary scenes.
Right. It says here, his self-exploratory texts reflect his search of how to be fully oneself, even to the point of owning one's sexual nature, without at the same time betraying one's values. His political activity is informed by the same ethos as suggested by his repudiation of communism after his 1936 voyage to the USSR.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, so this...
he was kind of the other end of the teeter-totter from...
McLuhan.
From Sartre.
Not an existentialist.
Not an existentialist, though. You know, it was a funny bunch of people. You got Proust sitting there, you've got Gide sitting there, you've got Sartre sitting there, and then the other bunch, you know, Breton and Saint-Exupéry and...
And Duchamp.
Michaud, yeah.
And Joyce.
And Joyce, yeah.
It says so, Gide's career, and he's born in 16... Go ahead.
Gertie Stein.
What'd you say? Gady?
Gertie Stein.
Gady? I never...
Gertie!
Oh, Gertie, okay.
Haven't you ever called anybody named Gertrude Gertie?
No, I haven't run across too many.
Okay. Well, you know, Gerd Stern and Gertrude Stein have certain funny little ring to themselves.
Yeah, the word's resonance, which is what your language poetry is like, resonating. But it says Gide's... Now, he's 1869, so that's way back there. Gide's career ranged from its beginning in the Symbolist movement.
Right.
To the advent of anti-colonialism between the two world wars. Okay, so that is, you're reading that in your late teens then, reading Gide. And he's talking about...
Maybe earlier.
Okay, but, only a year or two. Only a year or two. If you meet this UN guy in 45, 46, you're 18, 17, 18.
Yeah. I mean, maybe it was earlier in Gide, but I don't know where I... Oh, I wonder if I actually got a hold of Gide through the List Blouse. I told you about... I was going out with Doris.
The List Blouse, what's that mean?
The Edelbergs.
Oh, yeah.
In New York, as I was getting out of high school, that may have been where she came from. Not the
UN guy. Is Dorothy the Paul Goodman ex-wife? I don't remember who...
No, Doris, not Dorothy. No, that was Virginia.
Who was?
Paul Goodman's
Virginia.
Wife, Ginny.
So who's Dorothy? Or Doris?
Doris. There's no Dorothy. It's Doris Edelberg. I told you about her when I was in high school, and then her sister had this circle. Her sister was a painter.
Yes. And she got you down in the village.
No.
No?
No.
You were in touch
before the village. Before the village.
That's what I mean. I'm saying she was the one who got you into the jewelry store, 14th Street.
No, that was Elsie Peterson.
I think they'd laugh if they heard us arguing or discussing over these names. Matter of fact, somebody suggested that to me. All the spiritual listeners, William Burroughs, Ginsburg, everybody, Elsie, Doris, they're all listening to Gerd, the last man alive on the beach, describing what happened. They're all hovering a boat. So, yeah, Elsie and Doris. So, what did Doris do? Just remind us again the village.
Well, she had nothing to do with the village. Doris lived on the Upper West Side, and she was my girlfriend. But I used to spend a lot of time in her sister's room with Herbert Vogel and Henry Lenard and Eric and, because they got me involved in psychology and intellectuals and a lot of German background because they were all refugees.
I don't remember you saying this. That's interesting. So this is a scene in high school.
It's just as I'm finishing high school.
Okay. All right, we've looped back.
And Lotte, the painter, is still a friend of mine. She's older than I am.
The painter of that group?
Yes, the Doris' sister.
Ah. What's her last name?
Her name now, she's been married for decades, is Lichtblau, Lichtblau. At that time it was Edelberg, A-D-E-L.
Okay.
Yeah.
Where does she live now? Is she in New York?
On West End Avenue and 84th Street.
Okay, so what I'm thinking now is that Gide is what McLuhan would call the user is the content or the subjective content or the human being within the media effects. So you begin at one end of the spectrum, and assuming McLuhan is at the other impersonal medium environmental effect, you've gone to the other end 20 years, 15 years later. You follow what I'm saying? G's doing the subjective.
Well, I didn't have that kind of an impression because to me, Marshall had a very personal tone. That may not be the general idea, but his work was very textural. It's that whole thing about the soft and hard and
you mean the material qualities of things?
Well, I thought Marshall was into a lot of opposites, right?
Yeah, dialectic. He put on dialectics.
Yeah, and
that to you is textural?
Yeah, because it's bivalent. It's very bivalent. He talks about how the media are conducive in one sense and resistive in the other.
Yeah.
He talks about them being hot and cold, right? So he uses a lot of what is also very prevalent in Oriental mysticism.
Right. The
yin and the yang.
And the resonance of the eye and the ear in the pun. It's that thing I think of when you say text.
Yeah, and I had read Joyce before I read McLuhan, so I understood that he was, well-grounded in literature, and then I had also read, the British...
Lewis. Had you read Wyndham Lewis?
Yes, Wyndham Lewis, yes.
Well, that's pretty unique.
Before I read McLuhan.
Well, how did you hear of Wyndham Lewis? Since he was frowned upon in New York in the 40s.
I don't know. I think I read him in San Francisco.
Through the poetry scene, maybe.
Maybe through Rex Roth.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, there were a lot of poets around, and Wyndham Lewis was discussed.
That's good.
Whenever I heard about somebody, I tried to read them, you know.
Did you ever know Stan Brakhage, the filmmaker?
I knew Stan. Of course I knew Stan Brakhage.
Okay.
I knew him back here. I knew him in California, and I visited him in Colorado, where he lived.
Right, because he, at the Whitney retrospective in 2000, about they were doing underground cinema and all that, and he was there, and I asked him, what did he think of Marshall McLuhan? What was his opinion on McLuhan or take on McLuhan? He said, anybody who would defend Wyndham Lewis like he did is a friend of mine.
Stanley is wonderful, wonderful person.
Right, and
a wonderful filmmaker, but aside from that, he was a lovely human being.
Right, you remember him talking about Lewis?
No.
Because in his writings...
No, I may not have remembered it, but no, I don't remember.
Yeah, well, he made a big aesthetic in his film around the eye, and you could see he's probably influenced by Lewis's emphasis of the eye as a painter. You know, this big thing with the eye.
Stan was in San Francisco. He may have turned me on to
Lewis
for all I know. Somebody did.
Was that
Stan Brakhage was part of a group like Michael McClure.
The 50s scene.
What?
The 50s scene around the
Beatniks
and that.
Oh, well, a whole bunch of artists and poets.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, a lot of them are no longer with us.
Yeah, Stan died.
Oh, Stan's been dead for a long time, yeah.
Let me see. He died in 2003.
And what's his name? And, of course, Gary Snyder was part of that group.
Who?
Gary Snyder.
Yes.
And the guy who made the art and the films, he's still alive, but he's very sick. The Rat Bastards. And of course the poet who went and became a big Zen, who died, Philip Whalen.
Yeah. But here's the thing, Gary Snyder is 2 years younger than you, and Brakhage is 5 years younger than you.
I didn't realize that.
Yeah. Well, Brakhage, he was big. Yeah. When I saw him, he was
He was big, and he didn't look... I would never have thought that he was younger than I.
Right. Okay, so we spun off. How did we get it? We were talking about McLuhan. Oh, yeah, so the textural. Wyndham Lewis and the textural part. You mean textual, T-E-X-T-U?
No, I mean textural, like the...
U-R-A-L.
Yeah, hairy or, you know, something that you can touch and feel.
Tactile, yeah. That's actually tactual. One of the ways you say...
Tactual.
Yeah.
But I like the idea of texture.
Yeah. McLuhan said that he said everybody else was hypnotized with books and thought they were visual, but he found books tactile. So that's what you're saying.
Yeah, that's exactly. I found him very, you know, very, he was a feely writer. And he was a feely talker too, you know.
Yes.
He talked in images.
Right.
You know, you could visualize things as he talked.
And with your sensory training in poetry and music and that would prepare you to pick that up about him. Most people, I don't think, even thought he was writing that way. They thought he was writing like a technologist. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
they didn't know he was punning and putting this subtle other Joycean and Finneganese.
Yeah, I mean, you know, very few people write and talk alike. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Marshall wrote and taught. He taught the way he wrote, and he wrote the way he taught.
And most of his books are dictated, so it really was all just him talking.
Yeah. And he was a great talker.
Yeah, yeah.
And he could shift subjects like nobody. Boom. I mean, you were following him, and then before you knew it, you were in three different places already. It was fantastic. He was a collagist. You know?
Yes.
And I'm a collagist, so, you know, I was heavy into him. He was, if I could have spent more time with him, I would have.
Right. Now, Gide is a different kind of writer, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But but he's also textural. I mean, he's not abstract.
Okay.
See, Sartre, to me, is very abstract.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.